Hello, my name's Kate Rowles and I'm interviewing you for the Wellcome Trust as you're taking part in Anthony Gormley's One and Other. The date today is the 21st of July 2009. And if I can please ask you to state your full name, your date of birth and where you come from.
My name's James Mitchell. I was born on the 17th of April 1986 and I'm Brixton.
And how are you today?
I'm feeling okay. Had a bit of a journey to get here. Scoped out the people on the plinth already. They were interesting looking. Saw the crowd, a little bit nervous, but my perceptions of how scared I should be keep changing minute to minute. Sometimes I think it's going to be completely fine and it's the most normal thing in the world and it's the same as standing on the ground. And then sometimes I think, oh, it's this one massively important hour that you never get to do again and you should be very scared and perfect. So I think I'll find out how I really feel once I'm there.
And can I take you back to when you first heard the project and what it was about it that appealed to you and made you apply?
I think I must have been emailed about it by a friend who was a follower of Anthony Gormley, my friend Alex. And he'd signed up and he said that I should give it a go. And I had just moved out of home for the first time since university. So I had kind of put myself in the mood of why not try and do as many different things that present themselves as possible and just launch into things straight away and then decide if you're suitable for them a bit later. And I thought, if I wait too long on this, I will come up with a good reason why I shouldn't do it. So I set up as soon as I could, as soon as the sign up date happened, actually, and then forgot all about it. And then about a month later, got an email saying, you're on. And it was, then when I started to seriously worry about it, but I kind of convinced myself that it was impossible to back out and that I should just go for it. And I'm at this point, I'm glad that I've stayed on.
And how did you decide how best to use your hour?
I was really stuck on this for a long time. I kept kind of putting it to one side, not thinking about it. And then it must have been about a month ago, I thought, if I go there and look at it and be around Trafalgar Square enough, then surely something will happen or something will come to me. And I stood there and I sort of looked and thought, and nothing did. So I gave up and I went off to get some lunch somewhere. And I was going through Piccadilly Circus and I was by the statue of Antaros, the fountain in the middle. And this girl tapped me on the shoulder and said, excuse me, what's that? And it's the one thing in London that I know anything about from reading some book of trivia somewhere. So I explained to her what it was for about 5 minutes and then kind of realised afterwards that she couldn't understand most of what I was saying. But afterwards, I reflected that that was the kind of thing that I had always really, really enjoyed doing, was finding out about stuff, making it interesting and telling other people. And it was the stuff I'd really enjoyed at university, and it's kind of the sort of thing I do in advertising as well. So I thought, if the idea is to be true to yourself, then why don't I do what I love to do and find out as much as I can about Trafalgar Square and about London and explain it all in an hour in the best way I knew how.
So we'll
see how it goes. I'm going to be King William IV, who was the original candidate for the plinth. There was going to be a statue of him, but they ran out of money and it didn't happen. And then by the time I had the money, they decided not to go ahead. So I found this out. I felt he'd been cheated out of historical recognition. So I thought I'd be him for a bit and explain his story, because he's got an interesting life.
Yeah. Are you going to be in character?
Sort of, kind of. I've made a crown. I have made a crown.
What did you make it out of?
Yellow card from the Early Learning Centre yesterday. So it's not fully accurate, but it will be good. And I've kind of been him in character on the internet for about 2 weeks now during my research period, just talking to the Guardian Plinth Watchers on Twitter and the Sky Arts account, and just kind of getting people interested in what's going to be a sort of alternate history in a way. I think it will be good because if you think about it, all the other statues and monuments in this area and in all of London are designed to make you think about what they're about, but they really don't. And the people that come here to places like this climb on the lines, they climb round the column, look, but they don't really see what any of that stuff is about. And why should they, in a way? Because it's not necessarily that interesting unless it speaks to you. So if I do this, I'll actually be able to tell more of my story than the people who did get statues. So I think it will be interesting.
So you're going to talk about the history of the square?
In a way. But I discovered the history of the square is not as interesting as what it kind of looks to and what it reflects, and the themes that it brings up. So the connections between William's life and the Battle of Trafalgar, and, say, the war in Iraq, or the struggle against apartheid, or many, many other things, or celebrating the Ashes, or Michael Jackson's death. There was a big reunion here. It seems like Trafalgar Square is one of the few places in this country where people feel they need to go when something happens, just to be together. And I think it would be nice for someone to draw all the links together and make everybody reevaluate for what it is. Not just, it's not just an empty space, it's a space of people when they want to be. And it's weird, I read this interview with Nicholas Penny, the director of the National Gallery, last week, and he was complaining that Trafalgar Square was being kind of misused. There was too much noise and, you know, people climbing all over stuff and messing about, and there was kind of a side swipe at one another as well, that it was being used for performance and soapboxing and shouting, and that it wasn't art. But I thought, even if it's not art, it probably is true to the spirit of Trafalgar Square, in fact. So I hope to kind of to live that and make that real for people there.
And what are you going to be wearing to be the king?
I had thought about wearing a full costume, and then one of the early people I told said, you'll probably melt and collapse if you do so. So I'm going to be wearing a suit, because I think that's quite neutral in a way, because that doesn't really say too much, but with my crown to denote kingliness. When people come along 15 minutes in and I'm explaining about how I got drunk and started fights in bars in Gibraltar, they will know, hopefully, that it's not actually me, it's a character. But we'll see. The whole thing's designed to be quite, I've written just like little episodes so that you don't have to watch the whole thing. So I think that's how history works. You take the bits that you're interested in and you know, try and draw links between them, but you shouldn't have to memorise everything.
No. Have you got a book that you're going to be, like a guidebook or
a thing? I read a lot of books, and in the end I've kind of written my own, which has got all the notes in. I finished it yesterday. But I was looking at it this morning, I thought it was really nice. I've got a real thing to keep afterwards as a memento of it all. So I'm going to be referring to that. I hope it's got enough for an hour. But we'll see.
And can you tell me a little bit about you, not as the king, but as you, as James, and if you can say a little bit about your upbringing?
My upbringing is, I grew up in Surrey, so the kind of outskirts of London. So like London was a place you could go to, but it was still a big thing to go there. So I think people who live outside London, just far enough, see London as kind of Victorian London, monumental London, and like a big history thing. So I think that's why I thought of it in that way. My mum's a teacher, which very likely has kind of influenced the way I look at things. And I grew up in a house of books, of many, many, many books, most of which I must have read as a child or had read to me at some point or other, because I look at them now and look at the old kind of faded ladybook titles and think, oh yeah, I'm pretty sure I recognise that. And so I ended up doing English and history and that sort of thing at school, and then did English and classical history for my degree, which I finished about a year ago.
Where at?
At Exeter, which was very, very, very nice actually. It was very kind of, Exeter's quite good. You can take it in a lot of ways. You can take lots of different bits out of it. And I'd chosen to kind of do the learning thing on one side. And then in my spare time, I was a DJ, which came about as the first time I ever like did a part-time job and got paid. I thought, I've got to buy something cool. So I bought some decks and I learned to DJ. And then a lot of my spare time was taken up doing that and doing performance and stuff. And I've not been a performative person like at school at all. But that stuff kind of made me think, oh yeah, being watched and being really, really scared before something happens is really, really good fun, and it's really worth putting yourself through difficult experiences. So when I saw this and I thought this could be a difficult experience and it could make me really scared and worried, I thought it's got to be worth having a go at. So I guess what's going to happen today is the collision between learning stuff, performing, and making things up at the last second. So I'm hoping it will be quite a me thing to do in the end. Yeah.
Where did you DJ?
We set up a little club night in a club called The Cavern in Exeter. It's like this dingy basement thing that fits about 100 people in. And it was only ever going to be a sort of us playing for our own sake, having a good time sort of thing. But it sort of got out of hand and increased in scale quite quickly and started moving to other places, which really was a wonderful thing, because we thought we didn't care about that stuff. But then when people are watching you, suddenly it makes it very, very different, and it magnifies what you're doing, I guess. It makes you feel like you're doing something much larger, and you're being a much larger person than you actually are. So when it exploded and got to bigger places and we started taking more risks, is when it really felt like it was something worth doing. And so I've been doing that a little bit since I moved to London, playing in clubs in Brixton. And you get less and less scared each time, but it's always just as thrilling. And when I look at the streams of the plinth and I look at it, I get the same slight stomach lurch that I get before I DJ, which I take as a sign that it's going to be really good fun.
Mm. And hopefully. What clubs in Brixton do you DJ?
Last place I played at was a club called Mass, which is the conversion above St Matthew's Church, and it's kind of built like a church on the inside. And I'd got pally with this guy who was trying to set up his own drum and bass night, and who had been for about 6 months, and I didn't really know what to expect, but I said, I'll help you out, I'll do some of your online stuff, and I'll play for you for free a couple of times, and we'll see how it goes. And he said, okay, you can have the 11 to midnight slot on this on the Friday. And so I had to time everything very well. I got back from playing at a festival on Friday morning and slept for an hour or so, and then went over there. And it was so different to Exeter, just in terms of the people that were there and the attitude that there was. And it was, you know, ever so slightly scary, I suppose, to start with. But once music happens, I think you always find that people aren't so different. I think that's what art does, in a way. Or not high art, possibly, but like popular art makes people come together a little bit and makes you realise that people emotionally respond in similar sorts of ways. So when you DJ and stuff, when I've DJed, and you see a lot of people and they're all having fun, so they've got some sort of commonality between them, if you get time to look up and look at that and observe that, it's a very nice thing indeed.
Yeah. And who are you doing this for today?
I'd have to say I'm doing this for me, really. I think I could only do this for me. I admire and respect a lot of the people that have been gifted an hour and have, in a sense, sacrificed it for some other cause, like the goes on now, is doing it for Amnesty. I think that's very good. And I know the woman, the first slot was devoted to Childline, I think. And she kind of had such a huge opportunity to, she had such a weight of media focus upon her, and there were interviews and things like that. And she kind of deliberately passed that up and tried to focus the attention on her cause, her thing that she believed in. And I think it takes a certain sort of person to do that. I suppose if I have a cause, then the cause is just to make people think about history and think about history as it relates to our current lives and how we, you know, come together to celebrate, to mourn loss, sometimes at once in the same way. If I'm doing it for anyone and I want them to get anything, it's a sense that things are connected and things that have happened in the past are important, and that things that are happening today are very, very important, and that maybe people in the future will look at things that are happening today and we might not be in the same sort of, you know, statue building mood as people in the 1800s were, but hopefully they'll still look at the things that we leave behind and try and draw those together and make them mean something, so that big things, big sacrifices that people have made are not made in vain and they're taken seriously. So yeah, maybe I'm doing it for them. I don't know. We'll find out.
And what are your sort of ambitions?
My ambitions?
Yeah.
I don't know. I really don't know yet. I was very worried about that for a long time at uni. I thought I had to have everything worked out and have to have like a path to travel along. But now, ideally, I'm moving away from that a little bit. My immediate ambition is to get as far as I can in advertising. I'm an advertising planner, which is the guy who the brand gives all their problems to, and he looks at all the problems and says, okay, well, here's the real problem, and, you know, looks at the way people behave and figures people out and says, yeah, you thought it was because your thing's too expensive, but it's not. It's actually because it's the right price, but it's not good enough, or something like that. So I like that working out kind of thing, and I'm hoping to get a little bit further in that, because I do enjoy it, and I enjoy learning about new stuff every day. So I guess that's my immediate ambition, but long term, I would just like to make people think about stuff and be excited by the things that are around them. Yeah, something like that. I think if I ever had children, that's definitely the number one thing I would want them to do, is be inquisitive. Yeah, I guess, yeah, I just want to share a curiosity about the world I have with other people. Thank you.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before we finish?
I don't think so. I think we'll hear it all when it happens.